Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward.
Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity, part of the Podmatch podcast network. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And one genre that I feel does not get enough credit and enough of the spotlight when it comes to the various books out there is the Western. This was a genre that has been around for a very long time. And while other genres seem to have taken up the majority of the spotlight these days, this genre is alive and well, and it's because of people like my guest this week. W. Michael Farmer has been writing for quite a long period of time. He is not only a retired PhD physicist, but he's been able to put in over 10 years of research into 19th century Apache history, and he was able to blend that with his own Southwest living experience to create a real strong and very genuine series of stories that has definitely not gone unnoticed by the people in this industry. He has been a finalist for different awards. He is the winner of the Will Rogers Medallion Award for more than one of his books, especially his novels, Killer of Witches, The Life and Times of Yellow Boy, Mescalero Apache, Book One and Book Two, which is Blood of the Devil. And in fact, his latest book, An Apache Iliad, is scheduled to come out on the 28th of April. So we're going to be talking about this book. We're going to be talking about his other books. This is going to be a great time being able to get to know Michael and his own legacy in writing. So it is my pleasure to introduce my guest this week, W. Michael Farmer. Michael, how are you, sir?
I'm fine. Hello, everybody.
And thank you so much for being a part of the show. I'm really excited to have you here. And congratulations on An Apache Iliad coming out today.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to it. I finished it nearly 5 years ago, and because I had to change publishers and get on board with some books that I had written since then, it's taken a while to get it out, but I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. And can you tell us a little bit about An Apache Iliad, what our listeners can expect?
Yeah, Apache Iliad is the story of the last 10 years of the Geronimo Wars before he surrendered.
Oh, wow.
And it begins the one and only time that he was actually captured and put in a guardhouse. All the other times that he surrendered under terms and the army pretty well lived up to it. There are numerous books about the history of that time, which is a slice of those books. But I have read the stories and done the research, and I've been struck for a long time about how this is truly an epic American story that in many ways closely parallels the Iliad, the old Greek and Trojan War story that Homer liked to tell. And so I've looked at those 10 years as through an Iliad-like lens where there were great warriors on both sides. I point out that the reason Geronimo surrendered was in large part because he was deceived, just like the Trojans were when they pulled in the wooden horse, through lies that, whether they were intentional or not, that the army told him that just didn't happen.
So it sounds like what you're doing here is as I mentioned in the intro, you're filling in a lot of holes when it comes to the history that Americans would definitely benefit from knowing more about their culture. It sounds like you're doing a great job just providing that additional insight that will help them as we go along in this nation.
I hope so. The thing that I saw in my earlier years The way the movies and many novels portrayed the Apaches was that they were just a collection of bloodthirsty people who loved to scalp, torture, etc. What the real history says is that, for example, they never scalped or very rarely scalped anybody. And a lot of what they wound up doing, they were pushed into by the settlers and the Anglos not keeping treaties and promises that they had kept. And so when you start looking at the history, and everybody knows about Geronimo, or at least I used mm-hmm. to think so. A lot of the young kids don't have an idea who he is now. But when you start reading through the history in the regular books, it's so easy to get confused and lost about what happened here and when and how things changed and why he did this, that, and the other. And I've written what I call a series of vignettes. They're like 1,000 to maybe 100 words long about a little particular piece of it that it talks about the history and who did what and how it fits together in the whole scheme of things, so that you don't get lost in all the things that happened and who shot John. Right.
That's a good way to keep everything organized and also to keep the reader in line with where it is, with what is taking part in the story, and providing that additional backstory that's going to help them along the lines. Because if you just drop someone in without any sort of backstory, with any sort of story, they're going to get lost, they're going to get frustrated, and they're going to stop reading. What you're doing there is a nice little tool that I hope a lot of other people tend to do from time to time.
Yeah, the original impetus for my doing this was after I had written a couple of historical fiction novels. I had a number of readers start asking me, where does the fiction end and the history begin?
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that I really needed to provide the readers a written background that of the history that I used,
yeah,
and help explain what was actually going on.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it. And it's almost like an opening crawl to a film, just as a means of saying, this is where we are right now. So sit back. Here we go. Let's go ahead and tell this story. And so what was it that really led you on this road to writing in the first place? Because one of the things I love to hear about is what I call the road to creativity. And that's when you're on one road, but then all of a sudden you decide that you want to go in another way. And that's from experiencing something or seeing someone or reading something, and it just makes you go, oh, I want to do that. And then all of a sudden you're on this whole other path. You have a PhD in physics, correct?
I've been writing for a very long time, but most of that was technical papers. And I finished up my career doing a two-volume technical book that you could use in a graduate school, for example, on limitations of being able to see through the atmosphere or transmit a laser beam through the atmosphere for a certain level of resolution or what have you. And I got that book, or those books, it's two volumes, published, and wound up doing a number of short courses for the Society of Photo-Optical Instrumentation Engineers. But I had gotten in a habit of writing, and I was kind of looking around for something else to write for my own benefit, if nothing else. And I had just finished a history of Pat Garrett that had talked about the Fountain Murders. The Fountain Murders were Pat Garrett's last big case. Albert Fountain was a big-time attorney in Las Cruces, New Mexico, where I lived back in the 1890s. And times had really gotten hard because there was a big-time drought. The big cattle companies, which were using the Tularosa Basin, were overgrazing deliberately to drive the little guys out who had come in early and gotten the water sources. So there was a range war going on, and Fountain wound up butting heads with a rancher named Oliver Lee, who was a small-time operator. He had about 160 acres that he actually owned, but grazed a very large herd of cattle. And he was accused by many of cattle rustling in order to keep his herd up. And there were a number of scrapes and brouhahas between the small operators and the big cattle companies. Big cattle companies had hired Fountain to go after the little guys, and he specifically went after this gentleman named Oliver Lee. Lee was a phenomenal gunman. It said that 4th of July, I think it was 1884, he went to a July the 4th party, and cowboys were showing off their marksmanship, and he wound up being able to shoot dimes out of the air with a Winchester without a sight on it.
Wow.
And then he caught one of the cowboys to take a plank about a mile out in the desert, stick it up in the sand, and he hit it 5 times out of 6 with a Winchester 73. It's really unbelievable. He's also extraordinarily fast. And people, he wasn't trying to bully anybody, but they had just finished the Lincoln County Wars where Billy the Kid had been killed.
Yeah.
And he wanted the people over there to leave him alone. And this exercise was a method of letting them know they better not mess with it. Well, Fountain was convinced, he was the leader of all of these small operator rustling the big cattle companies to stay alive with their ranches. And he thought that he had the evidence. He went from Las Cruces over the mountains to Lincoln, where there was a grand jury, and he got the indictments. And his wife was scared to death that he was going to be killed. And she believed nobody would attack a man that had a small child with him. So she nagged Fountain to take Henry with him so that he'd be protected. And he turned her down, pushed her away, and finally he agreed to take Henry with him, who was eager to go. So they went over the mountains, stayed 2 weeks. He got the indictments that he was after. And when they were coming back, they got about to where White Sands National Monument is now and disappeared. And a big posse came from Las Cruces and found the wagon tracks had gone out in the desert. And when they got there, nobody was there. And in fact, their bodies have never been found.
Wow.
The trunk of papers that he had to get the indictments was gone. And it's a big mystery. The governor was under tremendous pressure to get the case solved quick. And he brought Pat Garrett out of retirement in Texas to get it done. Garrett took 2 years and found a little more evidence than what they already had. And the end result was that there was a trial in Hillsboro, New Mexico, about 100 miles north of Las Cruces, which was a mining town then. And Lee had a top lawyer who wound up being the Secretary of Interior a few years later. But the trial went on for 18 days, 75 witnesses, had night sessions. The jury got the case about 11:31 night, and the judge told them to go back to their hotels, get some rest, and start first thing the next morning. And the lawyer stood up and said, "No, we want it solved right now." So they went into session. 7 minutes later, they said not guilty.
Wow.
And to this day, nobody knows who murdered the Fountains. I had read a story by Oakley Hall, who's arguably one of the best novelists in the 20th century. And Hall said that the business of fiction is to find the truth, not the facts. And I decided that I'd fill in the time that I wanted to write, writing a story for myself short piece, maybe 20,000 words, that would help me understand who might have killed the fountains. I started writing, and 180,000 words later, I was done with that story. I got a well-known author to look at it, and she was highly encouraging to get it published.
Excellent.
Sent out 50 query letters, and I think I might have gotten one back and said, this book is too long. Mm-hmm. And I eventually did get it published by a small press in Sierra Vista. And I had discovered in doing the writing that I just really enjoyed it and like doing it, and decided that if I wanted to do something productive in my retirement, that's what I would be doing. And so I've been writing ever since.
Excellent. Wow. That is a hell of a story, and especially 180,000 words. Like, that is pretty remarkable. Did anyone ever recommend you breaking it into a trilogy, say like about 1,000 words per?
Yeah, I can't remember the gentleman's name. I know him very well, but I had proposed to split it into two pieces, and I really didn't find a convenient way to do it for the book that I wrote, and he turned me down, and so I just wrote another one that was a continuation of the first one, and so after a while I had my first trilogy.
Excellent.
And then I wrote a book about the story of the trial. And that last book, my publisher, who had been married to a retired policeman, discovered that she was going to blind and he had dementia. And she decided that she needed to close her business. And I'm sitting there with these books wondering what I should do next. I realized that the character of the Apache tribal policeman in the first book, who was named Yellow Boy and a Mescalero Apache, would make a good way to tell the story of the history of the Mescaleros from about 65 to 1950. I got as far as 1920, and I'm working on a book now that has the same character in it, but it's been a long haul.
That's wonderful. And so that's so prolific how you were able to get so much work done. And then all of a sudden, something would have happened with the publisher you had, but you weren't starting from square one. You had everything already at the ready, and it was just a matter of getting it out. And whoever you would wind up linking up with, they would have a hell of a library ahead of them.
I would hope so. when I learned that Five Star, which was considered the premier publisher, was considering books that were not put on them by agents, I sent them the draft manuscript of Killer of Witches, which was the first volume in a trilogy about the Mescalero Apaches. The story of Yellow Boy from the time he was a five-year-old child at Bosque Redondo when the Apaches were basically in a concentration camp. And 500 of them overnight, literally overnight, on the 3rd of November, 1865, disappeared. And the army was sitting right next door to their reservation. And they were literally close to starving. The army said they chased them, but they really didn't push it because they were running short of food. It was the end of the Civil War. The South was on its knees. And if the government had to feed somebody, do you think they were going to feed first? And so the rations that the Apaches were getting for living there were cut in half, and then they were cut in half again. And they also brought the Navajo that Kit Carson had defeated down to Bosque Redondo, and things went from bad to worse, and Yellow Boy wound up escaping with his parents and living with a band of Mescaleros in the Guadalupe Mountains there on the Texas-New Mexico line. And I was expecting to wait much to hear back from Five Star. And I got a call from one of their editors about a month after I sent it in. She said, I really liked your story. I'm going to recommend that they publish it. And yeah. As it turned out, they published quite a few. And then they decided that they only wanted to do large print and weren't going to do the regular size Westerns anymore. And that's when I had a query letter out to Casey Cowan. Yep. And I've been very happy with Ronan Weatherford ever since.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a great group of people there. And I'm excited to see what else they can do. They're doing some terrific work with the Western genre and doing their part to really spread awareness of it and hopefully get more people involved in it so that way they can get caught up on all these different things. And so it's wonderful that they're doing that. And I'm excited to see what they're going to keep on doing for all the other genres as well. So these are exciting times lies ahead.
I think it's a golden era for writers because even if a company doesn't take your work, you can always publish it through KDM or something like that if you're that anxious to get it done.
So if someone were to go in following your footsteps and want to pursue writing in this sense of working in the Western genre or in the historical fiction genre in general, what is something that you would recommend that they do? Because I love I love your idea of creating the context for everyone and then to drop them into the story. What else would you recommend that they do?
When you do your manuscript and you think it's finished and you've done all the polish you think you can do with it, give it to a good editor and pay the money to have it done, because that's really what will make you a good book. And I was like a C student in English when I was in high school and college. But since I've started writing, I've been acutely aware of the whys and wherefores of the way that you write things. And there's I think it's an artificial intelligence tool called ProWriter. Which you can chapter by chapter go through, and it will tell you where you left out commas, when your language is awkward, when your pacing is slow. There are about 20 parameters in there. And it's a tool, not a writing machine, as some people like to think. And so I think you need to be good technically and also be able to touch tough stuff that really rings your bell in terms of the story that you want to tell.
Yeah, absolutely. And definitely make sure you got your research down so that way you're not throwing in conflicting facts about things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Where can my listeners find you on social media?
I have a website, wmichaelfarmer.com, one word. I've got basically all my output on that. I've still got a couple of books to add to it, but it's generally comprehensive.
And I hope that those of you who have been listening to what Michael has had to say about getting into writing, doing historical fiction, going on the path that he went on that led him to Ronan Weatherford as his publisher, I hope that you're all just as inspired by this story as I am. And I just hope that you are doing your part to make sure that the work that you're putting out there is the very best it can be. And what I mean by that is make sure you have your research down, make sure you know which story you want to tell, commit to it, and get in. Don't be afraid to get into the minutia of things, because you never know what you're going to wind up coming out of this once you do your research. But by all means, just keep on pushing. If something doesn't work with one publisher, you very likely find another publisher that will take on that challenge. And that is that's what's happened with Michael. And that is what I hope will happen with all of you and your stories. May they find the right publisher, whether it is yourself or whether it is a small press, whether it's a bigger press, whatever. Just make sure that you are the right fit and then just do everything you can to just keep on creating your best work. Because in these crazy times, we need your stories, your ideas, your vision, now more than ever. So for W. Michael Farmer, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to hesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@hesgotit.com.